Welcome, everyone. If you have interest in hearing from a guy who's purchased 35 properties and over 5,000 units, you are going to want to hear from Kenny Wolf. Kenny and his wife both had the mindset to stash away a bunch of cash and then invest in their future. He transitioned from the oil and gas industry as a CFO to building a massive passive income real estate portfolio. On his first syndication deal, they distributed over 400% to investors. And get this, they still own the asset. That's the way to do it. And Kenny's the guy to learn from. Before we jump into the intro, I want to thank all of you. We launched the podcast just a few months ago, and we already have over 250 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. This has been amazing and so much fun. If you are enjoying the podcast, I've got a big ask for you. Can you please send out a share with a link to your favorite episode on your social media? That's right. Actually, share the podcast with all your followers on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, wherever. This is your chance and your opportunity to take action and help others get exposed to the wealth-building impact of real estate. I thank you in advance for what you're about to do. Now, on to the intro.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing, be introduced to the players that are getting it done, and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
A little background on Kenny Wolf before we start the show. Kenny grew up in Denver, Colorado. His father was in the oil and gas industry, and they traveled quite a bit, both domestically and internationally, as he was growing up. Kenny knew he was destined to build wealth, even at the early age of 7 or 8 years old. Looks like he's passing that on to the next generation, as he shares the story of his 10-year-old daughter, who already purchased her first rental property. Now, on to the show. Hello, everyone. We've got a special guest here today. We've got Kenny Wolf here with us. Kenny, I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, Darren, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So just a little background on how I know Kenny. So as many of you know, I got started in multifamily investing about 3 years ago. And when I did that, I was, you know, focused on learning. So I was reading a lot of books. I was listening to a lot of podcasts. And I started going to conferences and meetups. And I happened to go to one of Kenny's meet. He has a meetup that he has in the Dallas market. And I went to that. And I met a lot of other passive investors at that meeting. It's a very well-attended meeting. So I don't even know if we talked direct at that meeting. But I met other people, and he's got a fantastic reputation. So I went and set up a follow-on meeting with him at his office, and we met together, and he's just a top-notch guy. So I'm very happy to have him on today and for him to share his journey. So again, Kenny, appreciate you coming on. Just to start out with, can you give us a flavor for how many properties and how many units you've invested in?
Yeah. So we've done, by the end of the year, we'll have about 5,000 units. And then we've done 35 properties.
That is crazy. I think that might be the most I've had on the show. 35 properties, 5,000 units. That's amazing. That you've been busy for sure. So help us understand, you know, I read your book. So we'll talk a little bit about the book throughout this as well. But you know, you've got a meetup, you've got a conference that you're kind of co-branding with. You wrote a book. You've invested in a ton of properties. Help the listeners understand, before you got into real estate investing, you know, what was your career path?
So actually, I graduated Baylor University with an economics degree, which is about worthless. But I knew I wanted to.
Come on, you can tell us what's going on with COVID, right?
Exactly. Well, I got that down on a theoretical basis. But I went to night school, got my MBA, but also landed an entry level accounting job at an oil and gas firm. So that's kind of what was my track early on, was accounting in the oil and gas business here in Dallas-Fort Worth, mostly fracking and shale development here in the Barnett Shale. But anyways, quickly grew up in the ranks of that, made CFO at 28 years old. Wow. For a startup company out in Treeport. Got junior ownership in that deal. And then parlayed that into multifamily real estate.
So I graduated University of Rhode Island, went with Price Waterhouse, got my CPA. I started out as an accountant as well. And I still know people, a lot of people in that, you know, financial world. And, you know, you said you got promoted to CFO at 28 years old. You know, I know a lot of other successful people that were, you know, recruited out of the Big Six into private industry, started making more money, got promoted to controller, CFO. And what I saw was most of them would buy the bigger car, buy the bigger house, and kept in that track. And not all of them are particularly happy with where they're at, but they make great money, so they feel trapped. So, you know, at 28 years old, being CFO, I'm guessing you were making pretty good money for a 28-year-old. You know, what did you do differently that allowed you to make a shift at some point?
I drove a Taurus for way too long. you know, that was a big piece to it. And then we bought just a kind of your standard house. It was just my wife and I and our daughter, but at the time, so we didn't need some big house. So we were making pretty good money. It was like winning a scratch off lottery ticket every month, you know, on a consistent basis, you know. My wife and I look, we're not going to blow it on BMWs and Tahoes and all that, you know, huge house that we don't need. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity, sock it away and then, you know, do something big with it and kind of design our life around that, you know, using that money to work for us.
See, I mean, that's critical. Like, you planned for it. You knew you were going to make some kind of change and you socked away a bunch of money. I mean, that's something you have to do, is you have to plan to make that next shift. And it sounds like your wife has a similar mindset to you, that she was on board with that.
Yeah, she's great. She's a down to earth Texas girl. So I was very fortunate to land one of those.
Fantastic. So another thing I remember about you, I got involved 3 years ago, and you were probably one of the early ones that, because you live in the Dallas market, I live in the Dallas market. Dallas apartment market is, you know, hot, 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 and it's been hot for the last 3 years. But you were one that seemed to early on say, hey, I'm not going to chase this with everybody else. I'm going to start looking in some other markets. Help us understand, you know, how you formed that decision and what markets you went to.
Yeah, sure. So it was really, you know, I called it early, but I was I felt Dallas prices were high 4 to 5 years ago, or getting high, you know. So I was a little early on that call. But so I just kind of looked at a map and what's the closest next biggest city I could drive to was Oklahoma City. So on the way, so I went up there, toured around. On the way back, it was like, if I'm willing to drive 3 hours, you know, one way, so really 6 hours in a day, you know, why not get on a plane? For the, you know, because we're here in DFW, you've got a, you know, American Airlines or Southwest as a hub, so it's easy to hop on a plane, and that really opened up the map, right? And so really our first out of state acquisition was in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and then we went to Oklahoma City, and then Ohio, Columbus, and now we're in Cleveland as well.
Fantastic. So how did you break into those markets? Because, you know, the broker community typically, you know, they want to know who they're dealing with and before they award deals to you. So, and, you know, there's a lot of other investors that are in different markets that they know they don't want to invest in their backyard. You know, people in California or New York, you know they want to invest someplace else. They don't really know how to build that relationship and how to break into those other markets.
Right. Yeah, sure. So I always coach people is to, when you're looking to a new market, find the management companies first. because they're going to keep the brokers honest. And I've got a lot of broker friends, but you know, they're there to sell you something, right? So the manager companies that you can find the right one, and that's who's going to run your property for you since you're not in town, then you've got to really sift through them. And I always kind of tell the story of Columbus, Ohio. You know, so I had never been to Columbus, but I knew it was a great market by reading some the Berkadia annual, you know, multifamily magazine that comes out in January. I love that thing. I look forward to it every year. But at that point, 5 years ago, five, 6 years ago, they still had not surpassed their 2007 per unit per door prices. And it was a great, like the demographics were great. It was just consistent 2 to 3%, you know, population growth since 18, I don't know, 60 something when I did my research on that. And so rent growth was there. And so anyway, so I got on a plane, you know, went to Columbus, and before I hopped on the plane, interviewed two management companies up there that do B or C class multifamily. Liked one more than the other. Interviewed them there on site. And then that afternoon, I didn't tell them, but I picked four or five properties around Columbus in different parts of the city to go visit unannounced. That way, you know, you can see what it looks like when a new resident shows up. It also told me what areas of town I did not want to buy into. So I could mark out whole swaths of the city. And then the next day I met with a few brokers up there as well. It's a little easier if you have unit count somewhere else, but it's still a little tough to break in because you're the crazy Texan buying in Columbus,
right,
Ohio.
Right, right.
You know, so our first deal in Columbus was only 120 units. And for us at the time, that was kind of a small deal. But once we bought that 120, 6 months later we were buying a 216 unit A-class deal for 65 a door up there. At the time. And so that really kind of snowballs, but it seems like every new market, we have to buy a smaller 150 unit deal, just to break in into the market. And so once you're there, that would really snowball.
That's fantastic. And in your book, you mentioned a little snippet about fishing. And so talk about that. And that sounds like it's something that you hold dear to. If there's too many fishermen fishing in the same place, you know, find someplace else to fish. And that's what you basically did here.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we really, you know, we like DFW. We're actually working on a few deals now to put them under contract. But the reason why it's starting to make sense on those is because the interest rates have fallen so much.
Right.
And we're actually trading up into some pretty high end A-class stuff. It's trading at the same cap rate as a C-class here, basically. So I'd rather buy at a, you know, brand new A class or a high end A class at a 3% interest rate or below, at a 5.5 cap rate, than a C class. So, but anyways, it changes, right? So we are buying here in Dallas, but we're still, but it's a little bit, you've got to change your, strategy if it's getting overbought on the B and C space.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. What talk about reputation, because, you know, when I came into this business, you know, there's some names that bubble up and yours was one of them, that just has a solid reputation. And, you know, for listeners that are just getting into the space or want to get into the space, talk about the importance of reputation and how you go about building that reputation.
Absolutely. I mean, reputation is everything in multifamily. It's such a small world. Everybody knows each other or they know of each other. It's a very small world, you know, and it's a matter of fact of just being, straight up with people and not trying to nickel and dime them on a retrade. That word gets around very, very quickly around the community of who to do business with and who not to do business with. You know, so like when we're buying a deal, I've never retraded a deal that we've put under contract unless it was something, one, that they were hiding, you know, on purpose, or two, was like a roof or a foundation issue that no one could see from the ground. But you know, when we buy a building, we don't go in and like ask for a retrade for the parking lot or exterior paint, things like that. You don't want to be known as a retrader in the community, you know, and then always closing too. Every deal we put on a contract, we've closed.
So that was an important point. I was coming at it from a different angle, but you know, reputation is with the broker community, with the, you know, with sellers, that you have a reputation that you're going to close, you're going to do what you say you're going to do, that you're going to perform, that you can raise the money, all those things. And then there's the reputation, you know, with limited partners in terms of raising the capital. And limited partners, they talk to each other. You know, they go to these meetup groups and, you know, they might be a little bit, you know, on guard when they're talking to the syndicator, but when it's just the passives that are talking, they're very open about like who they like working with and who they don't. And you want to be one of the guys that they want to work with.
Absolutely. That's a huge deal. I mean, we keep our minimums low on purpose. You know, a lot of folks, you know, that are a lot of colleagues have pushed their minimums to 75, 100K. We've kept ours at 50 because we know up here that if we perform for our investors, they're going to tell five of their friends. And so we can grow exponentially. If we, you know, obviously make our current investors happy, do everything that we can to maximize their return, stay in constant communication. We do monthly updates. You know, I'm a passive on a hotel deal, and we get quarterly updates, and it drives me nuts. A lot can happen in 90 days, right?
So
we do monthly updates. We're pretty active on social media to let them know. Kind of when I was in Cleveland yesterday on a property, I did a Facebook post so they could follow us and see what we're doing there at our properties up there. So it's that constant communication that, you know, investors really want to see. And it's always, you know, there's always curveballs to every deal. I shouldn't say every deal, but most deals, there's curveballs. We all project them to go, you know, at a straight line up. Sometimes it's more of a roller coaster ride. So as we go through that, as we go through the business plan, if there's things we need to readjust, then we always have a plan and present that in our monthly reports to the investors.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now you, not only did you go into different markets, but you decided to diversify into other asset classes as well. So in addition to your focus on multifamily, you've also added additional investment opportunities. So talk about some of those.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started buying triple net and double net commercial properties about 3 years ago. We formed those under a fund and we buy multiple stores. So here in a few weeks, we'll add the 15th store that we own across the U.S. In various markets. And then did that really just kind of provide a different risk and reward ratio with just constant monthly distributions to investors because who we go after in those funds are high credit, publicly traded companies that guarantee the lease. So we know we're going to get our rent. We don't have as much appreciation most likely on those assets. But we're not buying it for that. You're buying it for the constant monthly cash flow. And then about 2.5 years ago, we jumped into development. So I didn't know what I was doing. So I bought the townhome lots myself, didn't take any investors and built out the team on that. Now we're working on an 88-unit ground-up multifamily development here in Dallas-Fort Worth. And then we just landed a big redevelopment downtown office asset that will convert to multifamily as well.
That's awesome. One of the things you said was, you know, you developed some of these products to have a different risk reward profile. And I don't know if this is what prompted it or not, but, you know, as, you know, you built that reputation and you had more and more investors wanting to do business with you, you know, some investors have different criteria that they're looking for and a different importance. They may be in a different part of their life. And, you know, right. So was part of that prompted by the needs of the investors that you were working with?
Absolutely. Definitely. It's always about the needs of the investors. And we wanted to give, you know, multifamily is great. It's a great asset class. It's got great depreciation. Once you stabilize it, fix it up, you can have great cash flow appreciation. But for those that wanted to, you know, diversify and have that monthly stable income, triple net was the best way to go to give them that. And then if those that want the kind of outlandish appreciation models, a little more risk, that's the camp that falls in the development and the redevelopment bucket.
Fantastic. And I've seen some syndicators where they will try to satisfy that need of kind of two investors by forming a couple different LP classes, you know, maybe one limited partner class is a higher cash on cash, you know, maybe it's 9 or 10%, but they don't share in the upside. And then the other limited partner class maybe has a lower, you know, forecasted cash on cash, but then they share in the upside. So do you do that as well, or you focus on the different asset classes?
We just focus on the different asset classes for now. We also do hard money lending. So for those that want the low risk kind of 8-10% return, then they kind of fall in that camp. But we haven't done different asset classes in our multifamily stuff yet. Deal. Right.
And the other thing you said was you set up a fund for the commercial deal. So how does the, you know, most multifamily deals, not all, but most multifamily deals, the syndicators go out, get the deal under contract. They, you know, scramble, have 60 days to close the deal, and they do their equity raise in that process.
Right. And
they're presenting the actual deal versus investing in a fund. So how is that looking into setting up a fund, and how is that different than the multifamily?
The reason why we do it underneath a fund is because we're mostly buying single tenant assets in this fund. So it's a little similar to buying a single family home, which honestly, I've never owned a rental, single family rental in my life. But from what I hear, you don't want to own one, you got to own three, because if one's vacant, the other two can cover the mortgage for the third one. So it was a very similar process. We kind of waited to kind of de-risk buying these single tenant commercial properties. They're great as a group because they pay constant monthly cash flow. So that was really kind of the reasoning behind doing a fund. And it gives, you know, investors come into the fund, and that fund owns several stores. First fund was 7 stores. The second one was 8. So we're building our way up on that front. But, you know, jumping from multifamily to a new asset class, the triple net stuff was like pulling teeth. You know, on that first fund, it was tough. I think they all lost. I believe they all thought I lost my mind jumping from multifamily, you know, doing that for 7-8 years, jumping into triple net, you know? So, it was pulling teeth. The first one, the second one caught on like fire at the end. I mean, we about doubled the equity that we raised. So, now that folks are seeing the monthly cash flow, I think they can, you know, put that in their portfolio, and we're seeing more and more folks come over.
That's awesome. Let's go back a little bit. Where did you grow up? And, you know, were you, do you have brothers, sisters, rich, poor, middle class?
Yeah, sure. So I was born in Denver. So I'm a big Broncos fan still to this day, even though it's a horrible season we're having this year. But I lived there 8 years. And then my dad was in the oil business. So there was a mass migration in the late 80s from Denver to Houston. So I lived mostly in and out of Houston, but overseas twice growing up. In junior high, I lived 16 months in Western Australia. And then, which is awesome, and there in Perth. And then the high school, 3 years of my high school was spent over in Cairo, Egypt. So I speak a little bit of Arabic and enough to get around town.
You've done some traveling. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty great life experiences. I was very fortunate. And then, you know, moved back to Houston for my senior year, right before my senior year, was bribed with a used Mustang. And then went to Baylor, and then hated the summers in Houston. So I went to Dallas, which is not much better, but a little bit.
A little bit better.
Plus human.
So your dad was in the oil business. You started out in the oil business. Look, there's a lot of people that make a lot of money in the oil business. You know, it's very volatile. Like you've got incredible great years, and then you've got these down cycles that can be very painful. But, you know, why didn't you just stay in the oil business? Why did you choose to get into real estate?
So oil business is great, but it's also either feast or famine, you know, in that business. And so actually my grandfather was also in the oil business as well.
Oh, wow.
On my mom's side. But anyways, so I grew up seeing the feast and famine. I mean, you're at the whim of an internationally traded, you know, commodity. So not only, you know, how much are you producing? Can you find it? It's also, okay, well, how much do the Saudis find too? Right. So it's always this feast or famine. You don't have as much control. Everything has a cycle, an economic cycle, but nothing like oil and gas.
So when you were young, did you think to yourself, I'm going to be successful? Like,
absolutely.
So draw a picture of that. Like what, you know, when you think back, like how old were you and what did that, you know, look like to you?
Sure. Yeah. So like, I mean, I think even as far back as 7 or 8 years old, I knew I was going to be wealthy. At that age, it was, you know, playing for the Denver Broncos and, you know, winning the Super Bowl and all that. Right. So,
quarterback?
You know, exactly. Yep. Quarterback and all that. But, I topped at about 5'11", so I wasn't quite tall enough, to make it, but anyway, so, but I always knew I wanted to be wealthy. That was always the dream. you know, I'd be doodling a mansion in a fancy car all the time, even all the way back then. So I knew I wanted to be, you know, wealthy, and kind of set myself apart and from that. So that was definitely a goal of mine early on.
You know, I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that it doesn't have to happen when you're a child, but I think it happens for a lot of people when they're a child that they have that kind of vision that they've cast for themselves. But, you know, if you're going to endeavor in anything, whether it's getting involved in real estate investing or starting your own business or whatever, I think you have to have that vision for yourself, you know, and you have to make a conscious decision that you're going to go after it and do whatever it takes to make it happen. And
yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I think that there's some people that just let life push them around and they just happen to be in a career because they got a job and they did it pretty good, you know, but it's not their dream.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the world would be a much better place if folks, you know, did what they love. Yeah. And there are CPAs that love what they do.
Right.
I've met a few, but I really think it would be a better world if we did that. And so, you know, that's something I always wanted to do is do that. And I mean, I was trading stocks at age 15, you know, on my dial up computer, you know, trading stocks. And I was at the time we were in Egypt and I was trading stocks there over here in the US. And, but anyways,
that's awesome.
And I've always been a big fan of Warren Buffett, even from around that age. I started reading a lot of stuff about him and studying him as well. So I've always wanted to had this entrepreneur spirit and you know, just wanted to make sure, because he talks a bit big about, you know, tap dancing to work. You know, he loves going to the office, not really work for him. And,
right.
You know, I didn't want to fall into the camp of, you know, kind of just drudging through on the work side. He spends so much time, you know, at your desk, you better love it, you know?
You better love it, right? And so I think that there's some people that, you know, have grow up and they have that entrepreneurial spirit, and, you know, and in them, and I did as well. But I think that there's other people that really have that in them that they want to try, but they don't have the influence and they just can't get themselves to step over the ledge. And again, that could be investing in real estate or it could be starting a business. It's hard, right? It's not easy, and you have to plan for it, right? Financially, most people, if you don't have the savings, it makes it very difficult to make that shift and take that risk. But, you know, plan ahead and look, man, life is all about like getting charged up and taking some risk. And the energy you feel when you're going after something that you love is so different than looking at the clock and waiting for Friday at 5 o'clock. I mean, so, you know, part of, you know, my why is, yeah, I'm looking for financial freedom like everybody else. And my number might be bigger than a lot of people's, but it's smaller than a lot of people's as well. But the other part is that, you know, look, if by bringing guests on like yourself, we can inspire one or two or three people to take, you know, plan, get educated, and then take action and try something, you know, I don't know one person that I've encouraged to go after their dream that did it, that came back to me and said, Darren, I wish I never did that. Like, they may not have ended up in the same exact place that they were trying to get to, but you know, they may have had to pivot to something else, but they're like, man, I'm so glad I was going to start this business. That one didn't work, but now I started this other business that I would never have found if I hadn't started, you know?
Absolutely. You just got to jump in. I mean, right out of college, my wife and I bought a tanning salon in North Richland Hills. And I call it her MBA because I already had one.
her MBA.
It cost us as much. And so anyways, but we learned a lot. I learned a lot, absolutely a lot about that deal. And the biggest takeaway was to go big or go home. So that's why we started in multifamily and skipped single family. It was just a way for us to, you know, we learned that lesson. It was a $50,000 lesson. But totally worth it, you know, in the long run, because we were able to, you know, set our sights like, okay, we never want to be bogged down in the day-to-day operations again. That sucks. And it pointed out too, that you can't grow as fast if you're stuck, you know, on the day-to-day. Right. So it was a way for us to really encourage us to skip single family and jump into multifamily, which in the long run, like I said, has been great. At the time, it was a little nerve wracking, but we learned a lot from it. You know?
Think about people that go after franchises, right? You know, some people may buy one franchise and then they're in it and they're running it. Well, they just bought themselves a job versus somebody else that goes in with the mentality that, you know, I'm going to buy 10, 20 locations and over and put competent managers in, you know, in charge of it. But it's funny because there's so many people, whether it be people like yourself that own over 5,000 units, 35 properties and have a great reputation, or, you know, other people that I've had on that own 1,000 or 3,000 units and, you know, maybe came, you know, a lot of people came from out of the country and started with nothing and built it up. But most of the people that I've interviewed have had some trip ups. Like I thought they're just, you know, an overnight success, right? And other people probably think that. And you think the same thing about actors and actresses and, you know, athletes, but they seem like overnight wonders, but they put in a lot of hard work to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. To be an entrepreneur and go out and make your own money, and feed your family, I mean, there's a little bit of a risk there, you know? Right. And you've got to perform. There's no option of failure. Failure's not an option. So you've got to go out and perform. And some folks can't take that stress. Right. You know, it's just not in them. I think you can learn it. I think anybody can do it. But you know, do you really want to is the question. And is it something that can you do that in something that you're passionate about as well?
You just said something fantastic there too, is that like you just have to find a way, right? I mean, I started back in like 2002 on a capital markets trading desk. And then I was in a training class with like six people. And this girl that was in my training class, she came over from another division of the bank and she was like a top leader, like, you know, she was just killing it. And she said to me, "Darren, what are you going to do if this doesn't work?" And I was like, "That's just not the way I think." Like, you know, right. I'm like, "What do I have to do to make it work?" Right?
Exactly.
And you've talked about all your deals, like you know, you go in with a certain business plan, and most of them have something that you know, you have to pivot and you have to figure out, and there's a little bit of a challenge. But you do what you need to do to make that deal right.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. You got to commit and go for it. Sometimes you got to burn the boats and just go for it, you know, starting out. So my daughter bought her first single family rental at the age of 10. Yeah, she did. So it's, that was about a year and a half ago. But she talked to me that summer, going that summer, she goes, "I want to make some more money." I said, "Okay, what are your ideas?" And she goes, "Dog walking or a lemonade stand?" And I told her that you're thinking too small. So I gave her the Rich Dad Poor Dad book, the real one, not the watered down kid version, but she read that in about a day. And then, when I came home that next day, she said, "I'm going to take over the family business one day." I'm like, "All right, it's working." And then she said, "I'm going to buy my first single family rental this year." I'm like, "Okay, that's awesome. And go do it, go figure it out. But you don't have the money to do that." Right. You know? So she came up with a business plan. She found the zip code she wanted to be in McKinney. And then she had been getting one or two Exxon and BP stocks since she was, you know, for her birthday and the holidays, for my parents. So she cashed that in. She had $5,000 to her name and that's it. And so, what she did is she did the business plan, found the zip code, pitched her grandmother because she knows I negotiate too hard with her, to form an LLC that she owns a part of to buy the single family rental house. Wow. And so, what's really awesome is that she didn't hear no. You know, I only have 5,000. There's no way I can buy a single family rental. I'm out. You know, it was that, like, I just, you know, go figure it out. Go, you know, if you don't have the money, make it a win-win for someone who does. And there you go. And so she's learned so much. And actually that property, they're about to do a cash out refi, probably in the next 2-3 months, where they can go pick up her and grandmother can pick up a second house with no more equity needed. So it's already snowballing, you know,
that is amazing.
Now she's about to turn 12. So it's, you know, it's that thing too. As a parent, you want to start your kids out thinking that way young, And I've been taking her on business trips with me to these multifamily properties since she was 5 or 6 years old. You know, making her talk to the managers, pointing out, okay, this is not how we have make readies look, or this is how what they should look like. You know, this is what a bad roof looks like, foundations, you know. And a lot of it probably went over her head, you know, on those trips. But a lot of it stuck too, I think.
Sure.
I mean, apparently, you know, for her to go out and go snag a single family rental at 10.
I think the biggest thing is that you and your wife must have instilled, you know, an abundance mindset into her. And because so many people, you know, that's where they get stuck, is that they're the people that are surrounding them tell them you can't do it. Right.
Right.
Like people that want to invest in real estate for the first time, like, oh, that's for other people, like, you know, friends and family, because they haven't done it. They don't know how to do it, you know?
Right.
But you told your daughter, go figure it out. You know, there's a way, you just got to figure it out. And wow. You know, that's going to change her life. Not
absolutely,
regardless of whether she's in real estate and financially, but just being able to think in her mind that, like, I can make this happen. And then she went out and executed. That is amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, I was always impressed by, if you hear the story about how Jerry Jones bought the Cowboys, he put under contract and didn't have near enough money, not even like, I think 10%. I forget what the number is, but he didn't have near enough money to buy the Cowboys. But he signed the contract and knew he was going to figure out how, you know, where the heck he was going to raise the money.
Wow. I did not know that. I did not know that. And I mean, what a great franchise to own. Maybe not a great franchise, you know, record wise this year.
Right.
They're not playing so hot, but still a great franchise.
Absolutely. So it's those kind of stories that, you know, newbies need to hear and read. So I'm a big believer in reading, you know, autobiographies on business folks. That's like my favorite genre, which is, you know, weird for some folks. My wife thinks it's a little strange, but I love it. I mean, I try to read as much as I can on how these guys and gals, you know, put together their business, how they grew from something, sometimes nothing, sometimes, you know, inheriting, you know, 30, 40, 50 million and growing it to much bigger. So it's just a way just to consume and model how these successful people, you know, hit their goals and dreams.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're a big reader, have you read the Sam Zell book that he came out with?
I actually have not read that book yet.
All right. You're going to have to read that one. It's called,
okay.
Am I Being Too Subtle?
Am I Being Too Subtle? Okay.
And you know, he's like the top real estate guy. I mean, billionaire from real estate. And I'll just share one little story from that book is, you know, he graduated law school, went to work for a law firm, and he was in that law firm for like 2 days. And he's like, I'm not going to be able to do this. Like, and so he went to the partner and said, I'm going to have to leave. Like, I just, you know, I'm not going to be able to do this. And partner's like, what are you going to do? He's like, I'm going to go into real estate. And he's like, well, why don't you stay in the office and I'll partner with you on deals? And so he did. And then he started making more money than all the partners. Like he just started crushing it. And other people were like, you're crazy. What are you doing? And then they're like, how do I do that? Right. I mean,
right.
You know, he took a risk. And so that is very important though. What you said is modeling after other people that have done it. And I'm sure you have a lot of people come to you and talk to you about how do I get into the space. And I've talked to a lot of people that reach out on Instagram and stuff. And some of them, it's mindset, man. It's like, they don't feel like they either have enough money, enough, you know, of a business track record, or, you know, some limiting belief that's going to stop them from doing it. And, you know, just setting people up to say, look, everybody is deficient in some way or shape. Maybe some people have money, but they don't know how to do it. Maybe some people know how to do it, but they don't have money. You know, put you know, them together and there you've got a good partnership. Man. So good. Let me talk about your book. Why did you decide to write a book?
Really, it's always been a goal of mine. I've had a table of contents for probably 4 years now.
Really?
And then finally, I just, you know what? I just committed. I said, okay, now just got to do it. Knock it out. So did
who
that.
Who was the first person that you told, like, okay? Because once you tell people, it kind of puts you on the hook.
Like, absolutely, right.
Who'd you tell?
My wife. I said, I'm gonna write a book, and so she's pretty good at holding me accountable for what I put out there. So, awesome. So that was it. I'm working on book number two right now. So.
Are you really? Okay. So this book is called Investing in the Dream: How to Acquire Multifamily Real Estate and Attain Total Financial Freedom. So I just want to hit on a few of the things that, you know, I read the book and some of the things that came out of it. One was, you know, make money work for you. Talk about that concept.
Yeah, I mean, it's you pick that up in the book "Richest Man in Babylon." That's always a good one, you know, for newbies to read. But you've got to have your money work for you. If your money is not working for you, you're going to work until you die for somebody else. So you've got to make money while you sleep. Warren Buffett's big on, you know, that mantra, and I totally believe it. So. And you know, you've just got to, the other big piece is just to start, you know, whether you're making an extra $200-$300 a month, like, okay, that's a great place to start. Now, how do you grow that to $10,000-$20,000 or whatever your goal is? Right.
That's huge. Cause you know, when I ask people on the show, you know, how does somebody get involved with passive investing? People always say, you know, first get educated. Right. And that's very important, you know, listen to podcasts, read books, go out and meet other people. You know, if you have the capital, I would recommend hiring a mentor that, you know, can coach you along the way. But what you just said is the last piece where people get stuck, and it's, you have to take action.
Right. Absolutely.
At some point you have to actually pull the trigger, and none of us, like, through all the deals you've been involved in, right? And all the deals I've been involved in and starting businesses, you never have 100% information. Like,
oh, right.
You know, you have to make that decision with the best information you have at that point in time and then roll with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's, and especially like if you work more towards like the development plays, you just have to, that takes a lot more like imagination and just, you know, and knowing that, okay, this is a great piece of dirt, because of, you know, X, Y, and Z is across the street and the traffic counts and all that. But yeah, you know, as you go into more of the development side, it's more of that creative, you've got this vision in your head kind of concept. You're buying, you know, existing buildings, there's a little less creativity, but that can be a good thing sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, there's more variables. I mean, when you're buying an existing property, you can analyze the existing cash flow, right?
Right.
But with a new development, like, you've got risk, like, okay, how long, you know, is it going to take to build? If that gets extended out, you've got a longer carrying cost. You know, I've heard just recently that lumber prices shot through the roof, you know, for new development, in like 2 weeks, they went up like 24% or something crazy. So all those factors are, you know, different than buying an existing property.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why it's that different kind of risk and reward ratio that we talked about earlier. But, you know, it's a little more spicier of a deal.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. So this is a, you had this in your book, and anybody that's involved in real estate and that's on social media has seen this quote over and over and over again. Don't wait to buy real estate, buy real estate and wait. And you also talked about, you know, the long-term investor and be patient. So talk about all those things kind of combined.
Absolutely. So, so we still own our first syndication deal.
In Wiley, really? Texas.
It's 76 units. We've pulled over 420% out to investors.
You pulled out already and everybody still owns the property.
And we still own the property. So it's been a tax-free 420% return so far today. Now, eventually when we sell it, obviously there'll be some clawback and some taxes to be paid. But, you know, we bought that asset in August 2012. So they've had all that money back. It still cash flows quarterly today. You know, it's an awesome deal. So because you have that, you know, we talk about the four wealth building blocks: cash flow, principal pay down, appreciation. And number four is the tax shield. that tax shield to get that money back and snowball that into another asset or another project. I mean, that's a huge tool that folks need to take advantage of. If you're going and flipping houses, one, you're paying more taxes and faster, which is really going to slow down, you know, your ability to compound your gains.
Yeah, that's huge. So I would imagine, so that was your first syndication?
Yeah, absolutely. 76 units.
And so if people are pulling money out, I'm guessing that some of those people were like, I like this Kenny guy. I'm going to reinvest what I'm pulling out back with him on another deal. Did you get a lot of repeat?
Yeah, we do. We have a lot of repeat. I think every deal on average so far, we've had about a 60% existing investor come into those deals. So, I think that's, to me, that's a little, I wish it was higher, but these are very, you know, capital intensive deals. So if you're putting in minimums of 50 grand, you know, eventually you're going to run out of money pretty quick for most people.
I don't know what the industry standard would be on that, but what I've seen happen with a lot of people is, you know, they make the shift over into real estate. And I was the same way. I pulled a lot of money on the stock market and started investing in real estate. But then you put it in a bunch of these deals, and then, you know, the business plan is 3, 4, 5 years. And then, you know, your money is in those deals. And at some point, people get tapped out.
So, right. Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. So we try to do a cash out refi or some kind of capital event. It's because we are long-term holders in the first 2 to 3 years of the asset. So that way we return maybe 50 to 80% of their initial equity in that first 2 years, depending on the asset. And that way they can go reinvest in other projects as well. We keep the asset so it cash flows, and we have that tax shield for longer. So for everybody to kind of snowball their holdings.
That's awesome. So that's pretty much the game plan is buy the property, increase the value, do a cash out refi, and then continue to hold the property.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the smartest way to do it. And I know a lot of, there's some gurus out there that talk about, you know, why don't you just, you know, sell the deal? And a good example is this. We just had a call. One of our investors wanted to have a meeting. We've got an asset in Columbus, Ohio. It's the one I talked about. We bought it for $65 a door. We paid $13.75 million for it. And we've got multiple BOVs, two different brokers, that should be worth about $23, $24 million. So we made a lot of money on that deal, right? Initial equity is $3.65 million. So we've made a lot of money. We also have a $2.4 million prepayment penalty today because of the low interest rates. And so, I kind of walked everybody through that. Look, so if we just hold the asset and it does not appreciate anymore, and so burning off that prepayment penalty, and then also, you know, calculating the principal pay down through the end of that prepayment penalty burning off, it was like a 20% annual return.
Oh my gosh.
A very low risk 20% annual return. So Who would want to sell this thing right now? It makes no sense because of that prepay. Now, I've heard other gurus out there say, oh yeah, sell it, you know, just pay the prepay and get out, get your money out. But where are you going to beat a 20% low risk annual return?
Right.
I don't know where you're going to find that, you know, find that because we already know the asset. We know we've raised rents 3 times during COVID. Our collections are amazing. I mean, it's all, we know this asset already. So it's easy, an easy 20% return, just holding on to it.
That's amazing. And that's when you get what they call the infinite returns. Once all the money is pulled out and you're still getting a return.
That's a dream. That's the dream.
So in the book, you talk about momentum. You know, at what point, you know, getting your first deal is the hardest, right? And then from there, you start building, you know, building one on top of the other, on top of the other. And your daughter is about to do that, you know, get her second house. But, you know, talk about that momentum and how that kind of builds and how long it takes. And when all of a sudden you start saying to yourself, holy cow, look what we built here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's been a great 10-year run so far. I started up investing passively twice, once in a value play to kind of see that big fixer upper model, here in town and in Arlington. And then, the second was was supposed to be a yield play. And I say that smiling because, anyways, it wasn't. So, but just see two different models. And then that actually, that second deal was a Fannie Mae loan, And that actually counted as my experience to get a Fannie Mae loan myself on our first acquisition.
You were a KP on that second deal?
Actually, I wasn't a KP on that second deal, but they counted it. You know, it's not black and white that what they put in, what it takes so
you
to
were,
get that.
You were but a limited partner in that deal?
I was an LP. You know,
I gave you credit for it.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure. I don't know how I did that. But anyways, it happened.
You called in some favors.
I didn't know anybody. So anyways, so 76 units syndicated that after those first two passive investments, and then bought a D class in Denton, Texas, 133 units.
D class.
D as in dog. Yes.
Wow.
I'm one of those that's not afraid to say that we bought a D. We bought a few Ds, actually. I just bought a new D, 3 weeks ago.
Really?
I mean, those are the deals. You know, we bought that asset for 34 a door. And I can't tell you what we sold it for in January, so I don't ding the buyer. But we made a lot of money, a lot of money per door on that asset. But it's a deal where, I mean, it's not going to cash flow for the first probably 2 years because we got to get our hands around it, fix it up, make it nice for the residents, and then, do the cash out refi and then eventually sell down the road.
Let me talk to you about that deal real quick. So, sure. So are you, when you get into that deal, what's the occupancy and why do you classify it as a D? Is it just have a ton of deferred maintenance and low occupancy, or what defined it?
Right. Yeah. So going in, we knew it had foundation issues, big ones. And it turns out it was from a lot of broken sewer pipes. So that was a whole nother thing. But we had to lift four buildings with interior beams at the same time, four buildings on that deal. I mean, you walk in the asset, it's more of a feel of the demographic that's there. It was also, it was the lowest rent and the last all bills paid property in Denton. I saw upside. I mean, just doing the math, just rubbing back water, $35 a month on each unit was massive. Just that alone. Right. We ended up rubbing that back plus all utilities at the end of it, by the time of it, but going into it, and it was rough. It was, half of it was on a chiller. We walked the units. There was a lot of holes of, fist through drywall kind of deal. There was a three bedroom unit that had 16 mattresses lined up against the wall.
Holy cow.
So that's who's living at this property. So it definitely was a D. Denton police knew that property and not for the right reasons.
Right.
So it was, it was one of those kind of deals. But you go in and, 34 a door, we probably put $8,000 to $10,000 a door into it by the end of it. So it was a big heavy lift. We probably replaced every piece of underground pipe in that play and that 6-7 acres, I think. It sure felt like it. but then at the end, we had this awesome NOI bump. And then on top of that, we had a great cap rate compression as well. It's actually the only deal I've ever bought off LoopNet as well.
Is that right? So that deal had to have been a bank loan. That was not an agency loan.
I was able to convince Fannie Mae to give me a loan on that deal.
Really?
And so it was a lot of painting the picture of the Taj Mahal of what we're going to do out there. If you're new to multifamily buying, always meet the bank out there when they do their inspection, because you can really kind of paint the picture, and no one can paint it as good as you. Painted the picture. It was 95% occupied.
Okay. So it was high occupancy. It was just low rent, bad demographic.
Very low rent. The economic vacancy was pushing 85%. Actually collecting was 85. So we were right on that cusp. So it was really that. And then they had also that same, Fannie Mae had also done our prior deal in Wiley of 76 units. So that, that always helps if you have a little bit of a track record with them as well, to pull that off.
Absolutely. So you mentioned you got into two passives before you started syndicating. Would you recommend that to new people getting into the industry to get into at least one passive before getting into being a lead syndicator?
I do. I think you learn better when your money is at risk, when you actually have your money on the line. It's also a way to see, like I did, I on purpose chose a yield play and a value play. Because I wanted to see the bipolar, business plans in multifamily. I also was coming from a totally different, oil and gas, coming from that, so I didn't know how to operate a property. I knew I needed to learn, not just, what each deal type looks like, but also, you know, who are the players? Who are the lenders? Who's the management company? Who's going to run this thing? Not me. You know, and so it was really a great way to learn on that front. And also too of, you know, I didn't like the reporting of how those two, you know, deal sponsors were reporting to the investor. So I made notes of how to improve that, kind of incorporated that into how our deals and, you know, just soaked it up. And so before I wrote that first $100,000 check as a passive investment, my hand was shaking when I was writing that because that's a lot of money.
right.
You know, a lot of money at the age of 28 doing that. But anyway, hand was shaking, but and I just let them know is that, like, this is my investment. It's also my education. So I'm going to ask a lot of questions, you know, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. I won't be too annoying. But this is my education too. So I, you know, if you're not going to be okay with that, then don't take the money. They took the money. And so I asked a lot of questions and learned a lot, by doing the passive route. And then, like I said too, that if you're able to get on a Fannie Mae loan, most folks will coach you that you have to be a KP or a guarantor to get that experience, for Fannie Mae, to be able to go get your own Fannie Mae card. And so that's, I'd also give that advice as well, is, being able to get on a Fannie Mae loan is also a great tool to be able to help you get a Fannie Mae loan right on your first syndication deal.
Yeah, you said a lot of things there, and I felt the same way. My first syndication deal, passive one, was half of yours. Mine was a $50,000, but I was scared. Like, it was the first, like, when I sent the wire, and I, you know, I've been trading my other business. I trade large loan portfolios. I've been trading like large loan portfolios for years and years, but one bank will wire the money in the morning, the other bank will confirm the wire. And, you know, I'm always in tune with what's going on and making sure that the money moves from point A to point B. And in this deal, I wired the money and I call a syndicator and I'm like getting no response. I'm like,
uh-oh.
Like, and this was a well-known syndicator. I had a lot of referrals. I met them, you know, had a great track record. But No response to text, no response. Oh, and finally I called and they're like, Darren, man, here's the deal. Like, the bank that we use, I can see there's a $50,000 deposit, but I can't see who it's from. I won't know that until the morning. And once I knew that, I was like, all right, I feel better. I was still a little unsteady at night, but next morning I got the email, hey, we confirmed your wire. And I used the same bank that they did. And sure enough, that's the way it was. So I told my passive investors ahead of time, hey, here's the deal. You're going to wire the money. I can't confirm until tomorrow morning. And that made them feel better, you know?
Good.
So
yeah.
It was a learning lesson because I felt scared. You know, I wanted to try to put them at ease.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. I agree.
So how do people, you know, when you coach people and they say, I'd like to get involved in a passive deal, like, how would you give the listeners advice on the best way to go about that?
So actually before that, I always ask them, there's kind of different paths, you know, do you want to end up being just going passive or do you think you want to try to be a syndicator in the future? Because those two paths are very, very different. So you always want to start with the end in mind, with your goals and especially on investing as well. So if you want to be a syndicator, I always tell folks, you know, be a passive in one or two deals, learn from it. Especially if you're new to real estate. And even if you're coming from single family, it's a little bit different of a world, going from single to multifamily as well, but it's a great way to learn. You network, you cut your, you know, you really shorten the learning curve of jumping into multifamily. So there's a lot less mistakes you're going to make. By going passive. But then also too, like, you know, I just flew back from Cleveland late last night, but I had one of our investors tag along. He thinks he wants to be a syndicator. And so, you know, what we've got, I don't do mentorship, but what we do is we've got a kind of an unofficial active passive program. TM, I got to trademark that, but an active passive. So this
maybe
is someone
maybe that'll be in your second book.
There you go. Absolutely. I gotta trademark that though. But it's someone who believes they want to be a syndicator. We've now been doing this for years because it was the same way with me on my first passive investment. You know, I asked them, can I learn? I want to learn this to be a syndicator. This is why I'm getting into it. So we probably have one or two people in each deal that do that. So, you know, this this investor flew up with me to Cleveland. We toured the assets up there and then, you know, flew back. And, you know, so he got to smell, see, touch what a C-class asset looks up there. And we've got a very big redevelopment deal in downtown, what that looks like as well. So it was a good learning experience for him, I believe. And not everybody wants to be a syndicator after they go along those tours a couple of times, like, okay, I don't know about that. you know, so, but it's a great way to learn. I mean, you've got to know that, you know, one way or the other.
Absolutely. And you said it before when you got into those two deals as a passive, it helped form the style and the communication style that you were going to implement afterwards. I think that there's so many different syndicators and they communicate in so many varied ways. And so to say, you know what, I like this, that this person's doing, and, you know, I don't really like this, I'm going to communicate a little bit differently. You know, by getting involved in a passive deal, that helps kind of form your mind, not only on the monthly communication, but also, you know, initially when you're putting together the investor, you know, deck and, you know, you're pitching the deal, like, you know, would I describe it the same way? Would I present it the same way? Or would I, you know, have a different slant on it? So right. I think that's great advice. Hey, you mentioned in your book that you ride motorcycles.
I do.
Do you still have a bike?
I do not have a bike at the moment, but I do get to hop on my uncle's Harley every summer up in Ohio. We go up there for about a week or 10 days. So
awesome.
So I still got it. But.
So I love to ride. I do not have a bike either. You know, it seems like when you get into the family world, like, you know, it's something that a lot of men give up. But I was going down to Austin to meet with some other real estate investors that ended up being guests on the show. And I was like, you know what? I've been wanting to ride for so long. I'm like, I just went out and rented a big, huge Harley and drove from Dallas to Austin and just coupled the business trip into an adventure. And it was great. So maybe sometime we'll have to get out and figure out a way to ride together. What else do you focus on outside of work? What do you like to do?
So we like to travel. Our family, we usually even, I made platinum on American in 2020. So
did you really?
I think I kept American afloat alone. So anyways, but that's for business, but also travel too. Like my wife and I went out to Aruba end of July. It was an awesome time to go. It was because there's 20-30% what it usually is on, you know, for tourists. So
yeah,
had the whole island to ourselves.
I went to Aruba once. It was really windy.
It wasn't that bad. It was end of July, so it wasn't too bad. Okay. It was warm, but you know, that's what happens end of July.
Yeah, I did the windsurfing, the you know, surfboard, but the sail, you know, windsurfing.
Windsurfing. Yeah. But there are a few out there. I saw a few of them out there on the tip of there. We like to snorkel and scuba dive. So we like to, you know, hit up the Caribbean and do all of that. But then we just like to travel with the kids too. You know, me growing up traveling, I got to see a lot of the world and a lot of different cultures, how other people live. I think it's important for kids to see that as young as they can. So we travel with the kids a lot too.
Awesome. Kenny, I really appreciate you spending time with me, with the listeners. You've definitely been a leader in the space and have a great reputation. And I look forward to continuing to learn and watch you grow. And this business is great because people, you know, ahead of you help the next guy, and then that guy helps the next guy down. And it's just a very collaborative industry, and people are partner with different people on different deals. So I appreciate you spending the time with us here today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Darren.
So if people want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
So we have a YouTube channel now. So that's
awesome.
One way. We put out a video every Thursday. Noon Central comes out. Just Google Kenny Wolf or go on YouTube and put in Kenny Wolf with an E on the end. But the best way to kind of get in touch with us is to go to our website, wolfwithane-investments.com. If you want to get on our email list and see what's going on up here, hit the big red subscribe button in the middle of that homepage, and we'll get you on the list.
Awesome. Look, guys, this guy has a great reputation. Learn from him. You know, get his book, attend his meetups if you're in the Dallas market. He's got a conference that he co-brands that is in a number of different locations. So check out his website. Again, Kenny, appreciate it. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed that one. Until next time, signing off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.